Inconceivable!
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Welcome to the first ever inaugural issue of the Good Trash Genre Cast. Tonight, the panel consists of myself, Dustin Sells. I'm a grad student at UCO in the 20th and 21st Century Studies program with a film emphasis. To my right, I have...
I'm Dalton Stewart. I am a senior sociology undergrad.
And to my left...
I'm Arthur Gordon. I'm also in the 20th and 21st Century Studies film studies program at UCO.
And as we said earlier, this is called the Good Trash Genre Cast, named by Dalton Stewart to my right.
Oh, thank you.
Dalton, can you go ahead and tell us why we call it that?
Yeah, there's a really great quote by Pauline Kael I came across a while back, and I'm paraphrasing here, but something to the effect of, you know, the movies are so rarely great art that if we can't appreciate good trash, then what's the point? And I think that really speaks to the heart of this podcast.
Because at this podcast, what we try to do is look at popcorn movies that would probably be considered trash by Pauline Kael and others. And so,
and her ilk.
And her ilk. So we are looking at those sorts of films. Tonight's film is going to be Assault on Precinct 13.
John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, sir.
The name is above the title, Frank Capra.
It is his first one.
Eat your heart out.
His first one. No less. His That's first name above the title, yeah.
So we're looking at the 1975 version. If you were looking to hear things about Ethan Hawke and Lawrence Fishburne, I'm sorry, you will be disappointed. But this is a great movie, and we had a really good time doing that. I'll do a quick synopsis, and then I'm going to give it over to Dalton. Arthur is going to sit out this part of the discussion.
Shame.
For shame, Arthur failed to do his homework.
Somebody's bad.
But that's all right. So, synopsis of the film is basically this. There is a precinct called Precinct 13 that is going to be shut down. And it's in transition from moving from one location to another. So there's a basic skeleton crew there. And then what happens is a set of street thugs have stolen a whole bunch of automatic weapons and have gone on a bit of a rampage. A young man and his daughter are out and about doing their thing. He looks much like Mitt Romney. And his daughter is shot. And he runs to the precinct. And the bad guys follow him there. And they all want to kill him. And there is a Alamo-esque showdown there in the 13th precinct.
I'm so glad I'm not the only one that thought he looked like Mitt Romney.
He looks exactly like Mitt Romney.
So much, specifically his inability to talk when under pressure. I'm kidding.
This is not a
political podcast. So let's get into it. I think that's a good snap.
Okay, go ahead.
I really enjoyed it. I had never actually seen this before. I watched the remake shortly after it was in theaters. But this was my first exposure to the original, and I gotta say, I really enjoyed it. Had a lot of the hallmarks, I think, of a great 70s action flick. You know, good grit. A lot of social issues get brought up, surprisingly, which is one of my favorite things about genre movies. And that's kind of why I'm here, is to give social context on things. You see this gang, who early on it's set up, they have a blood feud with the police. Because much of their gang members are killed at the beginning. So that's bad. Then they get automatic weapons. It gets worse.
To interrupt you, I have to say, editing and cutting, as you mentioned it, that shot where they're in that little channel canal concrete.
Oh, yeah.
You know, ambush sequence and the shotgun shots and the smoke coming up was really, really pretty impressive filmmaking.
And to me, there was something I really noticed was within the first 5 minutes of this movie, we have dead minorities.
Yes.
Killed by police officers. And I think that's a really important thing about this movie.
Trope alert. Yeah.
But yeah, things go from bad to worse to terrible, and it's all just a series of events culminating on top of each other until we finally get to the assault, which lasts for the final hour of the film.
It's 40 minutes
of setup and then an hour of an assault, which was just great. I mean, you really see a lot of, you know, you working around a budget. This movie was made for like $100,000 at the time, and it holds up with any Hollywood movie made during that era.
I totally agree, Dalton. I really had a good time watching this movie. The wife sat next to me, co-couching alongside me, and had a good time watching the movie. She mostly was incredulous to a lot of what would happen, but really, really just enjoyed the experience itself. And that is really what B-films and genre cinema is about watching a movie and having a really, really enjoyable experience that you know I watched something and I was entertained, And John Carpenter, you have entertained us.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. You know, really, really thoroughly enjoyed that bit of the film, with a small exception, which we will save for a moment later in the segment of this podcast. But let's talk a little theory now. Dalton has already mentioned the social issue, so go ahead, Dalton, tell us about
that. Well, I'll get into some things I thought were of note. You know, obviously there was a fairly big remake of this movie a couple of years ago, and I think it's really interesting that in that remake, the races of our anti-hero convict and our police officer are swapped.
Mm-hmm.
Bishop, which is the name of Lawrence Fishburne's character in the remake, and also our hero cop character's name in this movie, are black. And the convict, Napoleon...
Wilson.
Like Wilson, every, such a good bad guy name.
Like every Napoleon.
Yeah, is white, and then the remake, the cop is white.
And why is he called Napoleon?
It never says, and no. Damn it, I wanted to know. Yeah. I really did, didn't you?
I did.
I did. And I love that tease that I'll tell you sometime.
I do have to go ahead and throw out this one criticism as we talk about that, though, is that the dialogue does falter a bit.
It's got its hiccups. It really definitely does.
You know, that iconic Anybody Got a Smoke, I loved, but there were other places that were just ugly and cumbersome and clunky.
And I think I wouldn't go as far as to say it's a fault of the acting. I think the acting in this movie, especially for its time and, you know, its low budget, it's really quite good.
I put it on Carpenter.
I think that's good to say. You know, that's not really his strong suit in a lot of his films. His strong suit is atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not an actor's director. He's a technical guy, from all my experience with him anyway. But that's not to say that I don't think it detracts from the movie too terribly much. Some other things of note, as I said, we've got dead minorities within the first 5 minutes of this movie. And that's really important because it sets up the relationship between the police and the people of Los Angeles really early on in this movie. And shortly afterwards, they do make a point, actually, to point out during a fake newscast that this gang is unique in its racial mix-up. It's a diverse racial mix-up. So I think that's a really interesting thing to get at. There's one point really great before the tragic ice cream truck scene where the little girl says, "Daddy, we're lost. Can we ask the police for help?" And Daddy says something to the effect of, "You don't know much about the police," or, "Your teacher doesn't know much about the police, sweetheart."
Right.
So I think that's a really great moment in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's something I really did like in terms of gender issues in this movie. Mm-hmm. We get my two favorite archetypes of women in genre films, the cold, tough girl and the hysterical woman just completely useless.
Mm-hmm.
And those are pretty much the only two women I've ever seen in a genre movie. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to get them both on screen at the same time.
And genre managed to kill one and shoot the other one.
Yeah, it really did. And we can save that. That's a whole conversation.
That's
in and
a
of
wince,
itself.
Wince moment.
Oh, that was definitely
watching.
A wince moment.
Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting. You usually only get one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Women are either completely useless in genre films, or they are every bit as capable as their male counterparts.
Right.
And a lot of the times when they're as adequate as their male counterparts, they're very, very heavily sexualized.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of films like Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill.
Right.
You know, things like that. And in this movie, it really doesn't come out that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a... You know, you can definitely see the seeds of Ellen Ripley, I think, in this film. I mean, this really tough, macho woman taking care of business. And I think that's great.
And I think she is quite sexualized, though. You know, her interactions with Bishop the cop, you know, who, in all of his amazing Harry Belafonte handsomeness.
Oh, man. There's a great lie between them where she asks him if he wants coffee. And he goes, "Yeah." She says, "Black? For over 30 years."
Yeah.
And I love that moment. It was one of the best lines in the entire movie.
It was funny.
It was hilarious.
It was so good. But again, those, you know, those scenes are very sexually charged. Obviously, the relationship between her and Napoleon Wilson also kind of held a bit of that as well.
And I think what you're looking at is probably the seeds of a romantic subplot. What I was thinking at was the camera doesn't overly sexualize her,
I don't think. Right, does not.
Carpenter doesn't make a point to focus on her body parts, doesn't make a point to focus on anything except for her as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's definitely worth mentioning.
Yeah, absolutely.
My favorite weird thing in this movie. In the credits, it lists the warlords of the gang.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the warlords is credited as Oriental Warlord.
Nice.
Just a... it was another time, kids. That was a hard moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that, and I had to do a facepalm. I was like, "Oh, that's sad."
Yeah, and I'd agree. It's a bit dated,
but
overall.
Yeah, but, you know, it's dated in issues like that. But I think it really does make a point to show that race is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it throws that away.
Right.
I think that's something this movie really does make a point to say, these are important issues that we need to look at.
And I would tie into that issue of race, just the actual hordes of gang members that are coming
mm-hmm.
out. They are racially diverse.
Mm-hmm.
The strange bloodletting ceremony.
The tough guy bloodletting ceremony, I think.
At the opening of the movie is, you know, obviously is a black guy, a white guy, and an Hispanic
mm-hmm,
guy.
Yes.
And so we...
And our Oriental warlord, lest we forget. That's such a... But yeah, it is definitely a... It shows the racial diversity that exists
mm-hmm.
in Los Angeles then and today.
Right, which is not the case in street gangs. There's no realism there. Which is part of what leads me to my suggestion as far as a generic classification for this film is, yes, it does share some blood with the typical action movie. It shares blood with great Western movies like The Alamo and Rio Bravo and,
mm-hmm.
and some of those kind of movies. But I think the greatest place of sharing as far as tropes and conventions for this film is the zombie genre.
Oh,
I think
absolutely.
It's more
yeah.
Night of the Living Dead than it is anything
well,
else.
Well, you've even got lines like, should I save the last two for us?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there are some definitely great influences from the zombie genre on this movie.
And one of the things in the zombie film is that you see kind of this universalized proletariat coming at you
mm-hmm.
in the zombies. You know,
yeah.
the zombies
oh, yeah.
themselves are unlike other undead like vampires, which are more of a white aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
These are... Every shape, every color, every class, and much more lower class, typically.
Yeah.
And so there's that going on, and of course, I mean, they're faceless and,
mm-hmm.
and nameless for the most part. I mean, Asian warlord.
Yeah, well, we're not going to say that
three.
Again. Yeah, exactly. There's not a named villain in the film.
And so that I find that interesting. Also, what I found very interesting was the discussion between Bishop and Napoleon. When they're talking about going upstairs or downstairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was very reminiscent to me of, you know, I'll be the boss up here, you be the boss down there.
Yeah.
But they agree together, as happens in Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
Eventually, downstairs is the place to end up for that last stand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, the fact that it is a siege film
yeah.
itself, I think, lends itself quite a bit to zombie genre. And zombie tropes. And so that's the bit of theory that I would want to bring there is that how would you generically classify this movie?
I think it's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. A black protagonist, no less,
mm-hmm.
just like Night of the Living Dead. So I think it's a really good call. I wouldn't have thought of that.
So that would be the bit of thought. You know, again, these popcorn movies is good trash.
Absolutely.
It is good trash. Now, we need to talk about just one other thing. We already kind of quibbled a bit with the dialogue, and we do recognize it as wooden.
It's definitely not a film without problems.
And I'm bringing up an issue not knowing the opinion of my fellow panel members is John Carpenter's original score. Written by himself on a single synthesizer. Would this movie have been just fine to have not had any score at all compared to having that particular score?
I think I assume that means you hate this score.
I would rather drink a beaker of urine than listen to that score ever again.
You know, it's definitely not the best score in the world, but I will say that synth pop, man, I really feel like it adds to the atmosphere. It puts you in the, okay, this is a 70s movie. This is the 1970s, the mid to late 1970s. It's all synth pop, baby. And good or not, I think it really did put me in the... When those opening titles popped up and that synth pop score got going, I was like, okay, this is what's happening. I'm okay with this. So, definitely not the best synth pop score in the world. I mean, you want to talk good synth pop scores. There's films from last year like Drive that just knocked that out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I didn't hate this score. I really feel like it enhanced the mood of the movie.
My thoughts on the score are that John Carpenter is, early on in his career, I think the Halloween score that he does is fantastic.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, I have no...
Legendary.
No problem with that whatsoever. What I found to be appalling about the score...
appalling.
Is the repeated motifs that did not have direct correlation to either a character or a situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's that he wrote about four or five riffs and just repeated them. One of which included a single high note for a very, very long time.
That was a brutal high note. I'll give you that.
And I think that perhaps he should have been a bit more thematic. I think he does learn that later, but I found that to be a glaring weakness. As far as datedness and the years, I'm fine with those kind of things with it. I think it works.
I think it holds up really well, actually.
Yeah.
I recently saw Raiders of the Lost Ark in its IMAX re-release, and one of the gunfight in the bar, I was like, wow, this is not aged well. I didn't have a single thought like that in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think the sound design, especially the synchronization with the weapons fire and the weapon sound effects, that holds up really well. Actually, I think technically this movie still looks great.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a very, very solid movie. But I do have dialogue coaching tips I would give and score removal that I think should occur, with that. And which brings us to our next segment, which is the trivia / 6 degrees of separation segment of the movie. I'll begin with my first little piece of trivia, which I think directly speaks to this issue of scoring, is that it took John Carpenter 3 days to write the score for this film, and it shows.
I think it's interesting the movie's only shot in 20 days.
That is interesting.
That is a really short production schedule. And on $100,000, which again, inflation, that's just not good. But even then, that was not a lot of money to produce a film on.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think they really utilized the budget that they had.
It's no doubt a B-movie, and for that, I think Carpenter is definitely to be commended.
Oh, as far as, the B-movie greats goes, he stands up there in the Hall of Fame. He's in the Mount Rushmore of B-movies, I think.
Yes. Yeah. My 6 degrees of separation bit is the African-American inmate is Apollo Creed's trainer in the Rocky movies.
What?
And I found that to be quite interesting.
That is amazing. I
saw him, and actually what I thought was, I thought he was the same guy who was on the bus with Harrison Ford in The Fugitive.
Oh, okay.
That's who I thought he was at first. And I had to look it up. It's like, I know this actor from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking some of that that bus scene and the guy being ill and needing to pull over, those things really reminded me quite a lot of The Fugitive. But as it turned out, he was Apollo's sidekick. So the Rocky franchise, and that's pretty much all that brother did, I think. So,
and not a whole lot.
No,
going on
TV shows and whatnot.
There wasn't. I looked through a couple of the filmographies of the cast, and there wasn't a whole lot of extra work they did. I mean, this was really the seminal film for all of them. You could say. I didn't do my homework on 6 degrees of separation. I was gonna try to
shame.
I was gonna try to connect the original film to the remake in some way, either by probably using Carpenter as a root. If any of our listeners think they can do that, feel free to message us on Twitter. We'll give you that information at the end of the show.
And there will be a comment section on the bottom of the podcast.
Yeah, feel free to answer us in the comments, because I would love to see if that connection's there. I will say this, bit of trivia I thought was interesting. The original title of this film, the working title, was Anderson's Alamo.
Yeah.
Which really speaks to some of the Western influences in this. I know Carpenter specifically said Rio Bravo was a really big influence on this movie, so I think that kind of speaks to that. But I do, Assault on Precinct 13 is a lot punchier, I think. Mm-hmm. So good call on that decision.
All right, so the final verdict is, does it go in the trash or does it go on the shelf?
This one's going on the shelf. I might not pull it off every day, but this one definitely belongs on the shelf.
And I would agree totally. I would put it on the shelf. Arthur, we're going to ask you to bring you back in. Just based on the conversation you've heard so far, would you want to say that this is a movie you want to catch or not?
I think just knowing this movie's cult status, it definitely warrants a watch.
Mm-hmm.
And it is probably a very important piece of Carpenter's filmography on the whole, and is essential in his foundation as a filmmaker. So I think it'd be worth putting on the show.
It is. You should definitely check it out. Currently streaming on Netflix.
Currently streaming on Netflix, which is one of the requirements that we have here, is that we're going to get stuff that we want you guys to be able to see. And so it is on Netflix currently, so please check it out and let us know what you think, because that's a big deal. Now, we're going to go to our last section, which is my week, or rather our week in pop culture. And so we're going to just talk about what's going on in pop culture right now that we're noticing, that we are buzzed about. And so we begin to my right. Dalton, what's got you fired up?
I am extremely excited about the DVD Blu-ray release of Cabin in the Woods.
Yes.
Tuesday.
Woo!
Yes. It's currently streaming on video on demand. I believe it's available on iTunes for rental. I know through the Zune Marketplace on Xbox Live. It's available for rental. This is hands down one of my favorite movies of the year.
Yes.
Speaking easy. Of great genre film.
Easy.
Easily. Regardless of what comes out this year, this will stand probably in my top five. No exaggeration. I am not a huge horror film fan, I have to be honest. I have a great appreciation for them. There are a few that I love, but I wouldn't say I'm a horror connoisseur by any means. This movie is amazing. It deconstructs everything that you've ever thought you knew about horror films. I won't talk about the plot too much. Honestly, you can't talk about much without getting into spoiler territory. And I think you could probably give a synopsis without being too spoilery. But you should just go in with no expectations. It's a very fun movie. It's a very funny movie. And a legitimately frightening movie in places. I really love the cast of this movie, particularly Fran Kranz. Did some work with Joss Whedon on Dollhouse. Obviously, Joss Whedon was co-writer on this film. I really like him as an actor. I guess he does a lot of stage plays, and I'd love to see one. Also, a notable turn from Baby Thor, pre-Thor Chris Hemsworth, throwing in a subversion of the jock stereotype in this movie. But like I said, a great film, definitely worth checking out. Some notable things in my week in pop culture, not really current happenings. I recently read The Long Halloween and Dark Victory, which were two brief comic series in the Batman canon by Jeff Loeb, illustrated by Tim Sale. And they're kind of a continuation of Frank Miller's Batman Year One. They're set in the early days of Batman's career as a crime fighter. They definitely carry on. There's huge mentions to the plot of Year One, carrying on Batman and Jim Gordon's relationship, and pre-two-facing D.A. Harvey Dent. And this really builds on the relationship, both of these series, they build on the relationships between these characters in a way that you can clearly see the influence on Chris Nolan's The Dark Knight. He's even said that The Long Halloween was a huge influence on that film. Two great series I definitely recommend checking out. They're available on Amazon for like $15, very, very reasonably priced. Dark Victory also... the second of their collaboration also has an appearance by Robin, a new origin story for a young Dick Grayson that I think really sets his and Batman's relationship in the here and now. It's definitely a series worth checking out. Finally, on my way here tonight to our lovely podcast, I was re-listening to Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet.
Nice.
Hands down, one of my...
A classic.
Oh, classic. Probably one of the best hip-hop records ever made. If you've never gotten to hip-hop, I would put this in the beginner's guide to hip-hop. It's so great. You know, you want to talk about... They talk about issues that just do not get addressed at all in mainstream hip-hop anymore. The commercialization of art. You know, the subjugation of women in hip-hop mm-hmm. lyrics. Social and political issues. Really a great record. Obviously, the name alone kind of tells you a lot about what you need to know that's going on in this record. Chuck D is a great lyricist, a great rapper. Terminator X, the DJ, really great. And I know there's shared production credits on this record, but really just all around a great piece of music history.
But yeah, excellent, excellent, excellent all. We are very excited about that. Do check those things out. Arthur, what's got you fired up this week?
Man, this week I picked up season 5 of The Big Bang Theory, which is quickly becoming one of my favorite TV shows.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's one of the funniest things on TV right now.
Wow.
Even more so than How I Met Your Mother, which I know a lot of people love.
Yeah, a lot of people do love that show, one I never got into, but Big Bang Theory, it's endlessly, you know, it's one of those shows that comes on for like 2-hour chunks, you know, right about 6 o'clock, and definitely one you can sit down and watch for a while. Yeah.
I'm enjoying that. I also picked up the Yvette Brothers new CD, The Carpenter, for fans of Mumford & Sons.
Oh, okay.
Fleet Foxes, Civil Wars, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, I like them. I haven't heard of these guys. What's...
The Yvette Brothers.
Yvette Brothers, okay.
It was produced by Rick Rubin.
Oh, American Rick Recordings. Rubin.
So, really
nice.
Good.
Nice.
Really good thing.
Producer for Jay-Z, the Beastie Boys, very notable producer.
Mm-hmm.
All right, what's got me fired up this week in pop culture is the Barbarian Sound Studio, starring Toby Jones, and it is a British film that's coming out. It's actually a British film about a British sound engineer dubbing an Italian Giallo film, yellow film, in the 1970s, and the horrible, horrible things he must do to cabbages and watermelons and all of those things to make it look like the sound that you see on film.
That sounds fascinating. Actually, is Toby Jones the lead?
He is the lead. Oh, wow. And the what I if I understand correctly, and they were trying not to be spoilerific, and we appreciate that, is that the film itself has an occult devil worship witchcraft avenue towards it, and his repeated listening to the incantations of the witches ends up having a very, very negative effect on him.
Oh, wow.
Throughout. So,
sounds like a fun flick.
It sounds like really just pretty amazing stuff. And so I'm very, very happy in, that it's being made and would like to see that. I do like a good G.I.O. film, and so I'm happy that. I also have a personal pop culture reference moment. I picked up today a copy of Brandon Lee's The Crow at my local Walmart for $5. Alex Proyas, you must watch everything. Just everyone should know that.
Dark City, The Crow. Actually, I'd stop
knowing.
There.
You just know.
Knowing.
Even with scene chewing Nick Cage.
Knowing.
Ridiculous Cage.
The sci-fi?
Yeah, that's, it's him.
I do like Alex Proyas. He's put out some good stuff.
So check it out. Fantastic stuff. But in the line, and I'm going to be 32 my next birthday.
Okay.
But in the line at the Walmart, the lady asked me to see ID so I could buy a rated R movie. And I love her now, and I want her to be my new Nana. So this one, this shout out goes out to you, Walmart checkout lady, Wanda. Thank you so much for checking my ID.
That moment of youthful joy.
Where I thought, once again,
flashback
I'm
to high
still
school.
A child.
I also have a really intense personal connection to that movie. That Brandon Lee dying was a national tragedy in my household. I hate to date you. I was pretty young when that film came out. I think I was about 4 or 5. But, sorry, guys.
It's all right. Let the fetus talk.
I really love that movie. I had, you know, fond memories of endlessly rewatching that with my parents. It's a great movie. It really is. It is hands down probably one of the best screen adaptations of a comic book I think that exists. And Brandon Lee, you know, taken before his time.
Absolutely.
A good talent. Not a bad actor by any means, and also very capable of doing his own action scenes. Mm-hmm. And I would have liked to have seen where his career went. But sadly, we have this one great film to look to.
Absolutely. It's a very important film for me in my junior high angsty days.
Oh, yeah.
In which it came out. I was able to live those things personally. So, again, dating myself a little bit there. But great, great film. And just really, really stylish filmmaking. And what made me very happy about this particular copy is that sometimes that $5 bin at Walmart is just, you know, widescreen is kind of the major feature of any said film. And this has got a featurette, it's got a commentary track, and whatnot. So it's actually a pretty good edition of the movie. So I'm excited to give it yet another look because the old VHS copy I have taped off of HBO many, many moons ago has long since died. And so I'm very happy to have that now. So anyway, that wraps up the show for today. Those are all great pop culture happenings that are keeping us all excited and fired up. We'll be talking more about those things next week. If you want to follow any of the gang on Twitter, you can follow Arthur at RNDTBL. That's like Roundtable, RBW. And you can also follow Dalton Stewart at Dalton, D-A-L-T-O-N, Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T.
That is me.
And finally, you can follow me at Dustin _ Sells, S-E-L-L-S, and would like nothing better than to see your film tweets and your film responses to what we've said, and also check out what's happening on next week on the podcast.
And we'd love to get suggestions on films you'd like to see discussed on the Good Trash Genre Cast. We'd love some input.
Absolutely. But next week, we do have a decision we've made, and we're going to watch The Faculty.
The Faculty. A great movie by Robert Rodriguez pretty early in his career. He said to the actors on the set that, guys, zombies are coming back in a big way. This is definitely an homage to the Pod People movies of the 50s, and you can see, you know, his belief in the zombie reemergence in his film Planet Terror later in his career. Obviously, his belief got overshadowed by some big hits like the Dawn of the Dead remake. But I think this is the early seeds of Robert Rodriguez getting ready to help revitalize the zombie genre, both this film and films to come.
So we will be checking that out. I'm excited to see it. I'm a big Invasion of the Body Snatchers fan. And so I know there are some connections there, and I'm very, very happy to to see that. And so it's going to be a great film and a great time. And we'll have a great conversation. And I think perhaps you all may be interested in that. And I hope to see some questions beforehand. We might even answer a few on the show. Ooh, if you send me some.
Fun times, please do.
So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to the Good Trash Genre Cast. We are so, so glad that you did tune in. And we look to see you next time as we broadcast from the campus somewhere deep hidden in the corridors of the English Department here at the University of Central Oklahoma in Edmond, Oklahoma. We'll see you next time.